Happy New Year. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this January 1st, 2008. This year we go back 100 years to 1908, which began when a 700-pound electric ball fell from the flagpole atop the New York Times building. It was the first ever ball drop in Times Square. And as our guest recounts in his extraordinarily interesting book, America 2008, it ended December 31st with a 2.5-hour flight by Wilbur Wright, the longest ever made in an airplane. The book is America 1908, The Dawn of Flight, The Race to the Pole, The Invention of the Model T, and The Making of a Modern Nation. It's an attempt to recount the disparate events that Americans of 1908 confronted on their way into their own futures, confined to a single journey of the Earth around the sun exactly 100 years ago. Our guest is the author of America 1908, Jim Rasenberger. He is also the author of High Steel, The Daring Men Who Built the World's Greatest Skyline. Jim has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and he writes frequently for the New York Times, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Jim. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Kathleen.
I feel like I celebrated, the best of 1907 and 1908
yeah.
after reading your book, too. It was just a wonderful journey in time. You picked the right year somehow, didn't you? It's amazing what happened in the year.
It's true. And I didn't do it intentionally, believe it or not.
Huh.
I knew that I wanted to write about the early 20th century because in my previous book, I'd spent quite a bit of time researching in that area, in those first 10 years of the 20th century. I knew that it was just a fabulous time, and I had to revisit it. And then as I started to look into it, it just, one thing after another, happened in 1908. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to sort of go back in time and try to imagine what it was like to live in 1908? I mean, to sort of take all these events, all of which you could write a book about. I mean, books have been written about many of them, just dedicated to that one thing. But sort of put them all together and see how they correspond with each other, and with the ultimate purpose of sort of putting myself and the reader back in time and feeling what it would have been like to live then.
Yeah. And they've made much of it on the news today that it was 100 years ago when the first electric ball fell from the flagtop atop the New York Times building.
That's right. It was covered just 216 light bulbs, but at the time that seemed pretty dazzling. And, when I was watching the ball drop last night, I was sort of getting this sense of deja vu. I mean, as I was watching, it's a much more sophisticated ball now, but it's still basically the same thing. I spent so much time in 1908, and a lot of time, too, like sort of thinking about the beginning of the year. I begin the book on January 1st and then go back and look at the New Year's Eve of 1907. It was a kind of a stirring moment for me last night.
Yeah, I would imagine that it was. You begin the book with a young guy, Terrence, I think his name is, who's taken a bicycle ride in New York City.
That's right. He's a 16-year-old boy. I came upon his story in a number of the New York dailies. It was printed on January 2nd, and it was about an event that occurred on January 1st. And each of them were tiny little bits, and then some he's referred to as Terrence Kigo, and some as Terrence Tigo. And it's just a story of this boy who goes on a bike ride into Central Park, and he ends up having an accident. He hits a car, or a car hits him. It's not clear to me which one happened. And the man in the car happens to be J.P. Morgan Jr., the son of J.P. Morgan Sr., what I really liked about using him as a sort of a device to begin the book was trying to get into the head of a 16-year-old boy on the first day of 1908 on his bike. Because so much of what America was about then was like a 16-year-old boy. I mean, it was a very adolescent country in many ways, in both the good ways and the bad ways. It was filled with hope, filled with excitement, a sense of possibility, but then also a kind of that sort of you know, hormonal craziness that sometimes happens with teenagers.
Oh, it does?
And so it was, you know, it was kind of a crazy place in some ways. But that was equally attractive to me.
Yeah. One of the big things that happened that year, and I didn't realize how many horses there were in New York City and what they did to people's lungs, for heaven's sake,
is right.
The car. You know, the car hits him or he's hit by a car, and you describe how many people had cars and how they drove them too fast, but the internal combustion engine being a huge thing that was happening then, and it really transformed America in so many ways.
It did. Well, I mean, the thing with the horses, what's so striking about it now is city officials thought that the automobile was going to rescue New York City from air pollution because these horses, these 120,000 horses, left an average of 22 pounds of manure each every day.
Oh, my gosh.
And then this stuff would dry up and go into the air. It was supposed that people got all sorts of horrible diseases from breathing this stuff in, and the automobile was going to change this forever by getting, one writer called it, the absurdities of the horse-infected city. By getting rid of this, the automobile would clean the air and everything would be great. In 1908, as you said, America really did take a big leap forward in becoming an automobile nation. There had been cars around. There were 200,000 cars in America by the end of 1908. But Henry Ford, in October of 1908, introduced this new car called the Model T. It didn't look like much, didn't even go particularly fast, but it was a very good car, very well made, and it cost only $850, where most cars cost between $2,000 and $4,000, and opened up the possibility that middle-class Americans, and eventually, as the price decreased, working-class Americans could afford one of these. And you think of all the things that this did to America once Americans all over the country could drive cars. The highway system developed. So many things that we now take for granted, motels, fast food, the suburbs that many of us commute to, all really can be traced back to this moment when the automobile became a popular utilitarian item rather than simply a plaything of the rich.
Yeah. Tell us about the makeup. I didn't realize that we were as Caucasian as we were in 1908.
Yeah, it was. We were about 75% Caucasian now. In 1908, we were 90% Caucasian. Hmm. It was still a very white country. There were, of course, 1907 had been the largest year in immigration history. Almost 1.3 million people immigrated. And from Eastern Europe, where most of the immigration before had come from further Western Europe, the country was changing gradually, but it was still blindingly white, and still a lot of disparities between people. I mean, we still have those, of course, but much more striking between the classes, between ethnic groups, between the races, and between the sexes. Men and women lived in very different spheres in 1908. In some ways, if you look back at 1908, it looks a lot like the country we live in now. Certainly that's true in the cities. People rode the subways to work. They lit their homes with electricity. As of 1905, they'd started going to the movies. Nickelodeons had become a big thing. They had the Victrolas in their homes. They loved baseball. All these sort of pastimes and things that we now do to entertain ourselves, they were beginning to experience. But there were also these very drastic differences. They're particularly true in the country, where it was basically unelectrified. The country was only 7% electrified in 1908, which is kind of shocking if you look back at New York City, which is so brilliantly lit up. That's what I like, the ways in which it's similar to how we are now, and then the very striking ways in which it's quite different.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by the number. You forget this because it took a huge movement. A lot of people died to change all this, but the number of hours that everybody was working was unbelievable.
Unbelievable,
wasn't it?
I mean, the average work week for a working class American was 60 to 65 hours a week.
Wow.
6 days a week. And they got paid very little. Mm. And many of them worked in extraordinarily dangerous occupations, in steel mills, coal miners. I mean, to give you an example of how dangerous the work was, in 1907, 3,000 coal miners died. And in December of 1907, 700 coal miners had been killed in 1 month. Death was almost, for many occupations, death was a big risk that you took when you entered it. And it was still, we were an industrial nation that was growing very quickly. Immigrants were rushing into the country to take the place of those who fell. So there wasn't a lot of attention paid to the safety of workers, and certainly not to what their lives, you know, how happy their lives were outside of work. They lived in very desperate conditions, many of them.
And had no time, really, to do much of anything else if you're working that many hours, right,
Jim?
No,
they didn't. And Sunday was their day of rest.
Mm.
And this is one reason why when temperance laws began to come in the early part of the 20th century, working class immigrant populations like the Germans and others were so offended when the sort of the white Presbyterian population tried to impose laws on whether they could drink beer or not on Sunday. And because this was their one day to sort of sit back and relax, and they didn't want anyone telling them how to live their lives on Sunday, which you can understand.
The single largest industry was meatpacking.
Yeah, which is a strange fact given how much attention was paid to the new industries of steel, of the automobile, of coal. America was quickly becoming a highly industrialized country, but still we had a one big foot back in our rural agrarian past. 50% of Americans still lived on farms or in rural settings in 1908. And yes, meatpacking was the largest industry. I mean, we still lived from the land mostly. That was starting to change, but as I said, we still had this big foot back in our 19th century rural past.
Yeah. I was surprised how many products were around. Kellogg's, Nabisco, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Gillette, and Hoover, Budweiser, Pabst, Ford, and Buick were all around 100 years ago.
That's right. If you went into a supermarket, a shop in 1908, you'd see a lot of the same brand names.
Hmm.
And the products are not all that different than they were in 1908. It's a testament, I guess, to how tastes don't change in some ways, and also how these huge corporations manage to hold on. Now they've gone through a number of incarnations. Many of them been bought and sold and all that. I was sort of surprised by that too. A few of them I knew, but it's kind of when you look at old advertisements, it is kind of amazing how many of the products have the same names as they did. And here in New York, many of the shopping centers, not the shopping centers, but, you know, the department stores, Macy's, Bloomingdale's, same stores.
Hmm. Let's go to, I got to tell you, I've been to Springfield. I'm from Illinois, and I've been to Springfield many times. You talk about a footnote in history. Is this ever a footnote in history in Springfield, Illinois? You don't see any mention of this if you travel there, or I somehow have missed it. Shame on us. We have a long history of problems with race, but I had no idea this happened in Springfield in 1908.
Yeah, I mentioned before the big disparities between the races, and this was a perfect example of how bad things were for black Americans in 1908. In Springfield, Illinois, of course, the hometown of Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, where he's buried now, in August of 1908, whites tried to drive the blacks out of town, and there's no other way to put it. This one horrible weekend, and they lynched two black men for no reason at all, just the mob run out of control. And this went on for several days. It finally quieted down. But what's so depressing about it, in part, is not simply how this mob behaved, but also that the response of white Americans outside of Springfield wasn't stronger than it really was. There are a couple comments on this, that if this had happened earlier, after the Civil War, when the abolitionist spirit was still alive in America, there would have been a huge outcry. But in 1908, the outcry was not that great. Although, there was a silver lining in this, because the following year, a group of white and black Americans banded together and formed the NAACP, which was a beacon of hope and would go on to be, of course, as we know, in the 50s and 60s, a huge agent of change in America. So, you know, almost everything that I looked at in 1908, no matter how exciting or wonderful or how bleak and depressing, there was always this sense, you could always find in it the ray of hope. I think Americans then, more than now, were extraordinarily hopeful about the future and about mm-hmm. the possibility of changing things.
Much more hopeful than we are now.
Yeah, you know, there was a poll that I came up, it was by the Pew Organization, suggesting that barely a third of Americans are hopeful about the future of America, which is odd if you consider the fact that we live in a country that is richer, healthier, we have much longer life expectancies than we used to. Our lives are easier, you know. We referred before to how much people worked back in 1900. We work much easier days now. And yet we're more pessimistic about the future than Americans were in 1908, which is kind of odd. I think part of the explanation may lie in the fact that some of those same machines and inventions and wonders that inspired Americans in 1908, we now know that there are negatives that come with them. I mean, the automobile, for instance, still, you know, it's in 1908, it promised all sorts of liberties and freedom of travel. But now we know that automobiles can stick you in traffic jams and they, you know, pollute the environment. There are negatives that go with them. Airplanes were simply extraordinary things when they first flew publicly, when the Wright brothers first flew mm-hmm. publicly in 1908. But we've seen, you know, the bombing raids of World War II. We've seen 9/11. We know that airplanes are kind of, you know, they're not simply wonderful machines. They have a violent side to them, for lack of a better way of putting it. So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for Jim. Excuse me, our number is 800-486-8655. He's the author of the just-released, and it's a terrific book, America 1908, The Dawn of Flight, The Race to the Pole, The Invention of the Model T. Jim Rasenberger is also the author of High Steel, The Daring Men Who Built the World's Greatest Skyline. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times. All right. We have yet to talk about baseball. We have to talk about the Wright brothers, of course, amusement rides, politics, Teddy Roosevelt. Oh, there's much on the list. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with the author of America 1908, The Dawn of Flight, The Race to the Pole, The Invention of the Model T, and The Making of a Modern Nation. And we go to phone calls. Okay, Don is our first caller from Sparta. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoyed your guest's appearance on Book TV a couple of weeks ago and have that book on my list of things to pick up.
Hmm.
Today on Good Morning America, they were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the brassiere, and I wondered if how many chapters he devoted to that.
Sadly, none. Although I do devote quite a bit of space to the role of women in 1908, and one of the fun things that happened in 1908 was the introduction of something called the sheath dress. It started in May in Europe, first in. It made an appearance. Several women wore it at a racetrack near Paris in May of 1908, and then it appeared in London. And in late May of 1908, a woman named Bertha Carlisle, a showgirl in Chicago, wore it out onto the streets of Chicago. And it was nothing you would look at now and think was the least bit scandalous. It went all the way to the ground. But it was sort of hip-hugging, close-fitting. And it had the most, the Chicago Tribune had a wonderful word for it, disquieting. a slit running up the side of one leg, which was, you know, the height of scandal in 1908. But even then, the women wore, the style was to wear it with leggings. But she wore it out onto the street and caused a riot. There's no, thousands of people from the city came rushing in, particularly men, and surrounded her as she tried to walk down State Street. Eventually, she had to take refuge in a department store, and finally, you know, was
buy another outfit.
That's right. But this was—it goes to show you how, you know, how far we've come since then.
Yes,
if that's the way to put it. Because it was not—it really wasn't much, but it was, and it was covered not in the Chicago newspapers, in the New York newspapers, in the Los Angeles
Goodness.
Times, all over the place.
Goodness.
This was a big event.
Yeah, Isn't that something? Did you have something else, Don?
Yeah, I have another comment I could make. You mentioned the safety of mines and how we had a bad year there in 1908. And I think you said, what, 3,000 people in one...
In 1907, yeah.
Or 1907. I just recently read that in China, in 2004, they had 6,000 people die and that they average about 3,000 a year.
Mm. Yeah.
So their mine safety is at a state that we were about 100 years ago.
That's a good point. You know, there are a lot of similarities between where China is now and where we were 100 years ago. And as they sort of race into the future, the industrial future, which is largely going to be based on coal, it looks like, just like ours was.
Yeah.
So I agree. There's some interesting comparisons there. Mm.
Okay, good show. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so
Thank
much
you.
For the call. You do spend some time talking about what people wore in 1908, and it always has amazed me, Jim, that we wore all these clothes. You know, even when it was really hot outside, men had these high collar neck things and the ties and the stiffness, and women had tons of layers. It was a bit too much.
As I write in the book, fresh air seldom touched human flesh.
Yeah.
It seemed to be that, you know, you didn't want any flesh showing. And I can't imagine, and of course there was no air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Most people did not have electric fans. They suffered dreadfully in the summertime. There was really no way to get any relief other than the working class people who were, you know, the richer people would leave the city in the summertime. But the poor and the middle class were stuck in the city, basically, and they would ride the streetcars at night to cool off, or they'd sleep on the roof of the tenement buildings. You think, you know, how could they have, you know, suffered like that so willingly, and yet they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Don, so much for your call. Dennis is next, bringing us into baseball from Beloit. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I really enjoy the show, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. I'm kind of a lighter note. Baseball. You know, I'm a Cub fan, and
mm-hmm. This is your year. Then
this is your year. It's going to be 100 years, and my mother, who lived in 97, was 5 years old when the Cubs last won the World Series, and she used to remind people of that. She wanted to live to see another one, but I just wonder if I'll live to see another one.
Well, it should be this year because, of course, it was 1908, and I write quite a bit about baseball in 1908. It was an amazing year for baseball. Even before the World Series, the pennant race between the Cubs, the New York Giants, and the Pittsburgh Pirates was just a nail-biting thing that went on for weeks and weeks. And you may have, if you're a Cubs fan, you may have heard of the famous episode, of Merkel's boner, which was in late September. The Cubs and the Giants played in a game at the Polo Grounds in New York, and this young ball player, Fred Merkel, on the it was the bottom of the ninth. The Giants were at bat. It was a 1-1 game, and Merkel got to first base. Oh, there were two outs, by the way. So the Giants had Merkel on first, another man on third. The guy at the plate hit a single. So all that had to happen for the Giants to win the game was the Giants guy on third to run home and Merkel to tag up on second base, to tag second base. Well, Merkel, halfway to second base, peeled off and headed for the clubhouse and never touched second base. It was a fairly common thing to do then because fans rushed onto the field and would sort of, you know, jump all over the players. But it was the wrong time to do it because the Cubs noticed that he'd done this. And this a furious struggle began as the fans were rushing onto the field to get the ball to second base and call him out, in which case the game would have had to go on to another inning. This became an enormous controversy. It ended up being a 1-1 tie. That's how the umps declared it. And on October 8th, the Giants and the Cubs played a playoff game to decide who was going to win the pennant. And the Cubs won, of course, and went on into the World Series. But it was that game was known as the greatest game ever played at the time. And it remains one of the greatest baseball seasons in history. Forgotten even by many baseball fans, not Cubs fans mostly, but it really was just, you know, you can't believe the sort of twists and turns that one baseball season can take.
Except the fans went a little overboard at times, didn't they, Jim?
The fans went completely overboard, and it was, I mean, well, you know, one odd thing about baseball then is the fans, many of them would stand in the outfield, behind ropes, deep into the outfield. So they had very close contact with the ball players, and they were never embarrassed to show either their affection or displeasure with a ball player should a game not go their way. So, this explains why Fred Merkel ran off the field, because either they would be, hoisted up on people's shoulders and carried off, or if the fans were unhappy, they would literally beat the opposing players. The Cubs on that October 8th game, the Chicago Cubs really had to worry for their lives from the New York fans. From the moment they entered New York City on that October day, they were constantly being pelted by things, and at the end of the game, ran to the clubhouse.
Goodness.
And then one by one, they got out of their baseball gear and one by one slipped out into the crowd so nobody would know who they were. They were really afraid of bodily harm.
Well, Dennis, good luck with the Cubs this year. It's the year.
This is the year.
This is it.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
Brian from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm interested in the concept of hope and pessimism.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like I'm not disputing what you're talking about, but I'm just curious as to how you gauge it and then how you compare two different points in time.
That's a great question, because you can't make a scientific comparison because there are no polls that I can use from 1908. There are polls now that measure the satisfaction and the optimism of Americans, but not back then. So I do it it's an interpretation on my part from everything that I've read. I spent 2 years living in that 1 year of 1908, and you do get a sense. It's inevitably a little vague, but it's a sense of feeling, and it really infected everything that came out of that year. I'm talking about the daily journalism, the weekly journalism, letters, autobiographies, and also the actions of the people who lived in 1908. They were no doubt a more future-oriented people. I mean, you can get this from the newspapers that almost, not every day, but constantly would run articles looking deep into the future and asking panels of experts to predict the future. In fact, I on January 1st, 1908, exactly 100 years ago from today, the New York World ran an article entitled 1808, 1908, 2008. And it looked back at how far the country had come between 1808 and 1908 and all the wonders of 1908. And then looked ahead to what the world, what America was going to be like in 2008. Most of its predictions were way off. It had this idea for gyroscopic trains and wave energy, that we would be getting our energy from waves by this point. But the point that, is that there was a great deal of this obsession almost with where the future of America was going. This was expressed in Teddy Roosevelt. He was in May of 1908, he had a conservation conference in which he invited all the governors of America to come to Washington. And his entire cabinet came, the entire Supreme Court came. And this was for conservation, which is kind of, it's hard to imagine this happening now. And spoke about how we had to look deep into the future, not for our own lives, not even for our grandchildren, their children, and so on. Much more sense. I think now we live more sort of by election cycle, by financial quarters. I think there's a lot less concern about the deep future. Certainly about the next few years, but you don't see so much about the deep future.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Unless you had something else, Brian. Oh, thanks very much for the call. Let's spend a few more minutes on Teddy Roosevelt because he's worth it. He's such an intriguing guy, isn't he? And in some of the book, or some of his clinging to rocks on this climb in Washington's Rock Creek Park, the Republican convention, his standing ovation. Give me a sense of how in 1908 people thought of him. Was he a hero to a lot of people?
Yes, he was. Mark Twain wrote of Roosevelt that he was, first of all, clearly insane, but secondly, that he was the most popular American who had ever existed. He had this extraordinary way of managing to irritate just about everybody, because he would change his, you know, these days we'd probably call him a flip-flopper. He would said everything with absolute conviction, but he had no problem changing his opinion about something not too long, you know, briefly, I mean shortly later, and saying something different. He changed his mind, which is not such a bad thing, I guess, in a president. But he said everything with such passion and conviction. Americans, even though he would, at one point or another, he managed to irritate just about everybody, I think they appreciated the fact that he wanted to be president of the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
He made that very clear, that he wanted the square, you know, his famous phrase. He wanted every American to get a square deal, and he went to a lot of effort to make that happen. But he was, you know, I thought I knew quite a bit about Roosevelt before I wrote this book, but I had no idea what a fantastic figure he would be to write about. He's just, no matter what you can say about him, you can almost say the opposite. You know, he was such a paradoxical guy, and so, on the one hand, so you know, boisterous and would do crazy things and had this kind of swagger to him. But he also was probably the most intellectual president we've ever had. He read two or three books a night. He wrote dozens of books himself. He was a well-traveled, cosmopolitan, extraordinarily thoughtful guy. So he managed to encompass just about everything good and bad about America, and was, like America itself in 1908, sort of bigger, stronger, smarter than everybody else. You know, he had this great sense of pride about himself and about the country. He's an amazing figure.
Yeah, oh, that is a great description. Derek is our next caller from Madison. Hi, Derek.
Hi.
Hi.
Great show for today. Hey, I come from my side of the family. I'm a child of immigrants who came after 1908. My wife, though, her great grandparents were freed slaves or knew of freed slaves. So her grandparents growing up, when they were children, were acquainted with people who were freed slaves or the next generation thereafter. And so that's kind of the, you know, I know that was the world back then. It was, you know, you were only one or two generations away from slavery. And I know that, you know, for most of them, you know, there was, you mentioned earlier how difficult things were for them. In that environment, though, I do understand that there were some African-American descendants, you know, descendants of slaves or slaves themselves who were able to get education, some of them doctor's degrees and able to, you know, progress through professions and things like that. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on how that worked. What were the channels and institutions that helped them out? And if that type of institution was so helpful back then, when things were tougher, is there any chance that they could also apply to today when things, as bad as they are, aren't quite as dire as they were 100 years ago?
Yeah, it's true that there were exceptions. You know, one of the great leaders of African Americans in that part of the early part of the 20th century was W.E.B. Du Bois, who'd gone to Harvard, was extraordinarily well educated. But the spirit that led to many Black Americans being educated came out of the Civil War, and I think it's fair to say that it was stronger in the late 1800s than it was in the early 20th century. And the reasons for that are very complex. But it's certainly the case that progressive white Americans, that same group of Americans, well-educated white Americans, who had stated the case of Black Americans and had stood up for Black Americans before the Civil War and after the Civil War, had abandoned them. For a number of, you know, it's extraordinarily complex why that happened, and I could talk about that for a long time, and I don't even really understand all the reasons. But it had to do with things, new theories about genetics. That was one thing, where there were theories that were not existent earlier in the 19th century, that blacks really were inferior to whites. So well-educated whites started to believe that. So there was less of an effort to bring them into the good colleges and educate them. The boys had been educated in the 19th century, not in the early 20th century. Things were as bad as they ever were for blacks in the early 20th century.
Hmm. Well, yeah, when I did talk to my my wife's grandparents, it's interesting that you brought that up about how, you know, at that time, you know, the people who were, you know, progressive had kind of abandoned it. And yeah, it was ideas of, you know, the Darwinism, eugenics, and those kinds of philosophies came in, and someone who never abandoned them, it's almost to a person, you know, I got it from the book by Thomas Sowell that the vast majority of freed slaves that were educated through high school, beyond high school, and got the advanced degrees were all taught by Catholic nuns.
Hmm. Hmm. Thank you, Jared.
That's interesting. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, when he came into office, many black Americans thought he was going to be the second coming of the great emancipator.
Yeah.
And he got off to a good start. He invited Booker T. Washington to dine with him at the White House right after he took office. This was a very hopeful sign to black Americans, but Roosevelt was just blasted for doing this by the Southern press for kowtowing to blacks, and even by the Northern press somewhat for making a stupid political move. Hmm. And he never did it again. And he's kind of abandoned blacks himself after he did that. I have to say, several times writing this book, I sort of had to stop typing and just take a moment to reflect on what it must have been like to be black in America in 1908, when you had no friends but yourselves, you had no one to lean on but yourselves, and there were two schools of thought. One was the Booker T. Washington school of thought, which was that blacks should accommodate themselves to whites and try to get along in the white world. And then W.E.B. Du Bois came along and said, no, we don't have to do that. We are our own people with our own pride, and we will not simply try to slip into white culture. There were very few whites of any political bias who came to their support. Hmm. So it was a very difficult time.
Thanks, Derek, so much for your call. We'll take more of them in a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, Jim Rasenberger is our guest, and his book is America 1908, The Dawn of Flight, The Race to the Pole, The Invention of the Model T, and The Making of a Modern Nation. He's also the author of a book that some of you may have read, High Steel, The Daring Men Who Built the World's Greatest Skyline, and he's a frequent contributor to the New York Times. We also have an email. If you want to send us one of those, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Happy New Year, everybody. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have lines open if you'd like to speak with Jim. The phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. A reminder to you that we are going to Des Moines, and we're going to broadcast the day of the Iowa caucuses from 9 to 11 Thursday. We'll have Democratic and Republican caucus goers, and I'm sure – I don't know how many candidates are going to be floating around in Des Moines, but you can be sure that they'll stop in and say hi if they're there. Friday, we will – it seems like this has been going on forever. Friday, we will know the results, and we will be doing a broadcast again from Dubuque at the Mississippi Mug, and I'm looking forward to it. We're going to have a good time. I'm bringing cake, too. I wonder if it's too early to make the cake today, and then I'll frost it tomorrow while we're on the road, and then I'll eat it on the road. No, I won't do that. All right, the number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. But before we talk about some of the other events in the book, I'm just wondering, Jim, to have spent 2 years really living in another year, I'm just wondering what that was like for you. You must have walked around New York and in 1908 in some ways, and you were making comparisons. Did it affect
that's
you?
That's absolutely the case. And yeah. I even got to the point where when I would sign a check, I would sign it 08.
Oh, my gosh.
07. So,
oh.
You know, finally, at least those people to whom I wrote those checks can cash them now that we're in 2008. But I think, to my wife and kids, they're going to be very grateful when I can stop talking about 1908. Because everything that I lived in currently, it would sort of refer me back to 1908. And it was kind of like living in a time machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope the book does that.
Yes, it does. Oh, it does it beautifully.
Because I think that's part of the fun of it, and to sort of go back and live in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it really did sort of get into me, and it still is. And I was just telling someone the other day that I miss it now. I sort of miss pieces of it that I can remember working on and living in for weeks at a time. In fact, you mentioned this wonderful stroll in the park that I described with Teddy Roosevelt, where he went clambering up these rocks, and he was followed by just one man, a man named Archie Butt, who was sort of a military aide. And he'd been entrusted with the president's life on this walk in Rock Creek Park, and the president kept trying to do things to kill himself, it seemed. You know, he'd take hike up the hills, he'd fall back, and then he'd go right back up the rocks, and it was a terrifying moment. But I was telling you, I missed that, and I missed hanging out with Roosevelt. And I write about Roosevelt's last Christmas in the White House in 1907. And this Christmas, I was reflecting quite a bit upon that, particularly when you know how things what came afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
World War One was just a short time after. All four of Roosevelt's sons went to World War One. Three of them were injured.
Mm.
His beloved son, one of them was Quentin, was killed. It's there's something very poignant about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I think you should do another year, don't you? Obviously, people have told you this, but but why not? Why not?
Well, you're right. I'm probably doing a different kind of book now.
Oh.
But I know that I would like to come back to this part of the century.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just find it a wonderful place to spend time in it, and I think also the fact that we still live so much in the traces of that century.
Yes.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
so much of our technology, other than the computer and the internet, is still 1908 technology. I mean, it's the automobile and the airplane,
mm-hmm.
electricity. Many of these things that were new then are still define our worlds. It hasn't really changed that way.
And we should talk about the airplane, Orville and Wilbur. I didn't realize how completely different their personalities were and how nerve-wracking all of this must have been to have all these people standing in your field waiting to see this happen and break the records.
Right.
And holy Toledo, it was quite an event.
It was. I mean, the Wright brothers had first flown, of course, at Kitty Hawk in 1903. Then they flew again near Dayton, Ohio, in semi-privacy. They were trying to be very private about it in 1904 and 1905. And then they stopped completely flying because they were very concerned that having discovered the secret of heavier-than-air flight, airplane flight, that somebody would come along and steal it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 1908, and really September of 1908, the late summer of 1908, that Wilbur and Orville proved to the world that they could fly. And at the beginning of 1908, most Americans probably still had not heard of them, and those who had heard of them probably thought they were bluffing, that they really hadn't done it. Because if they did know how to fly, why weren't they flying in public? Well, finally, in late summer, Orville flew near Washington, D.C. at Fort Myer, and Wilbur went over to the enemy territory of France, where they thought they were the ones who were natural flyers, and he flew at Le Mans, France. And this was just one of the most mind-blowing months in modern history, because first they went up for a minute, and then they went up for a couple minutes, with Wilbur flying in France, Orville flying here. And then Orville, who turned out to be the better flyer and the more avid flyer, got up two flights of an hour, and then 70 minutes, and then 75 minutes. And then on September 17th, he crashed.
Yeah.
Well, he had a passenger in the plane with him. and the passenger, Thomas Selfridge, died. Extraordinarily dramatic. And many people thought that that was going to be the end of American aeronautics, that this would sort of put the rights under and the French would now take the mantle. But 4 days later, back in France, Wilbur flew again for 90 minutes. And then on the last day of the year, December 31st, 1907, he flew for 2 hours and 20 minutes. And you have to recall, how extraordinary that would have been, given the fact that most people at the beginning of 1908 really had no idea that humans had learned to fly at all.
Yeah. Rose is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to have the author say a few words about whether he explored the socialist movement of the U.S., because during that time, Milwaukee had a strong socialist movement and was, I'm not sure what the dates were for the first socialist mayor, but we had socialist mayors for a long time who cleaned out the corruption in government and gave people an optimism, I think, that you might have noted.
Yeah, that's true. Eugene Debs, the socialist candidate, ran for president in 1908 and was on a whistle-stop tour for much of the year. Socialism was, the numbers were never huge, but as you say, there were some cities where socialism had made quite an impact. And it was, I don't spend a huge amount of time on it, except that there were so many movements happening then, socialism being the prime example, of Americans trying to find a way to make America a fairer place. So much wealth had been created at the end of the 19th century and start of the 20th century, and it was pretty much going all into the pockets of the wealthy. Still at that point, 2% of the country controlled 60% of the country's wealth. People knew this was wrong. Teddy Roosevelt knew this was wrong. He knew that this had to be fixed. The question was how to do it. Do you spread it out evenly to everyone, or do you make a fair playing field so people can have a fair shake at getting some of it, or exactly how to do it? And socialism was a solution that many people took to in that part of the century, along with other things. It was part of the excitement, I think,
Also, the legacy of Milwaukee from the socialist era are the parks, the services.
Sure.
It was known as the cleanest city in the country, and so on. And it was more that government was to serve people and not people to serve government.
Well, this was, of course, the beginning of the progressive movement, which was not socialism. Progressives believed in capitalism. They believed that basically the American system was the right one, but they just wanted to make it fairer. And they began by wanting to do little things, not little things, but a fairly limited agenda of cleaning up city government and of busting trusts that were controlling so much of the wealth. And then that spread out into other things. A big thing in 1909 was the playground movement. Now it seems like sort of a not that big a deal to have playgrounds in the cities, but there were very few playgrounds in the cities for poor kids at the beginning of the 20th century. And progressives believed that if you could take children out of their tenement homes and off the streets where most of them still played and give them clean, supervised playgrounds, you could turn them into better people. Now, this contradicted the element that I mentioned earlier that was happening then, that many people were suggesting that genetics was determinative completely, so that when people were born, they were born into their personalities and there was nothing you could do to change it. Well, the progressives didn't believe that. They believed that the environment, nurture, not just nature, mattered, and that if you could clean cities up and bring social services to them, you can improve people's lives and make them better people so that they could in turn contribute to the country.
Hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Just about a minute left, but I think we have time for you. Mark Spring Green, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, you?
Good, fine,
good.
Thank you. Very interested in your show, great show. I haven't read the book yet. I haven't had an opportunity. I just wanted to see, I live in a log home that was constructed in 1906, and I got to know the family members that built this home, and they were farmers, they were agricultural people, and they had an incredible amount of can-do spirit, this family. There's only one. There was 13 children.
Oh, my gosh.
And the last member of the family is 102.
Ugh.
Living in a nearby town.
Wow. That's amazing.
They built the house. The log house was constructed out of oak logs that they harvested on their own land here and had a sawmill rig set up. They hired a guy to help them build the log home. Agnes used to come out and visit me. She passed away 5 years ago. She gave me some photos. The photo of their family with the first four children, I believe, standing in front of the original log cabin on the property, barefoot. I invited her out every summer. She would come out and tell me stories about the history of this place.
Well, you got your mind in it 100 years ago as well.
That can-do spirit you talk about just infected everything. Out west, in the Midwest, it was there. And, of course, immigrants who were flooding into America at an extraordinary rate, they came to America, even though they many of them fell into rather difficult circumstances. They came to America to make a better life for themselves.
We gotta go at this point. We're out of time. Thanks, Jim. Do another year. It was a great book.
All right.
Enjoyed it. Thanks. Jim Rasenberger, and the book is America, 1908. And thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. John Treader as well. Happy New Year, everybody.